Richard Steenen of IT Harvest is here and visiting Washington to present later today and examining some of the really difficult challenges the federal government's facing in cybersecurity. And we'll talk through those during our conversation. But what do you see as an outside observer being some of the looming challenges that maybe aren't front and center today in federal government cybersecurity, but are on the horizon and will be in our faces before too long, Richard?
Yeah, so the federal government is finally totally on board with the threats, and they understand that things are in really bad shape and they have to do things about it. Unfortunately, the space moves so quickly that the technology solutions available to do the sorts of things that Lockheed Martin was doing 3 years ago are just coming on board now. Mm-hmm. And I don't see the federal government, any of the agencies I've talked to, in a position to actually go out and buy those things. You know, it might be another decade before some of the security analytics, the deception software that's coming out, some of the advanced intrusion prevention technology, all new companies, some of them Israeli. So it might be very difficult for them to actually buy the right technology.
Mm-hmm. So that strikes me, fortunately, I guess, as a procurement problem and not as a technology problem. So that strikes me as far more solvable than we're not capable of executing the technology, or, and I'm not suggesting the government isn't, but we're not prepared, we don't have the resources, whatever, because the procurement rules can be fixed and there can exceptions can be made if the arguments can be made to Congress and all that, it seems to me at least. Is that a fair assumption, do you think, or is it more complicated than that?
Yeah, that would be nice. And I've certainly seen examples of, you know, the right two-star inside the military or the right CIO just saying, I need this, figure out a way to get it. Mm-hmm. And they get it on trial or pull it out of some other budget and work. But the only way they succeed is by working around the procurement rules. Mm-hmm. And, you know, procurement is just a morass. That's why, you know, the military procurement is in such trouble right now. Mm-hmm. And certainly for large systems, I mean, we're seeing that, you know, just getting bridges built is a difficulty for this administration, at least. So I think the procurement is as big an issue as all of the technology issues.
The technology issues that face chief information officers, CISOs, and now we're seeing a rise, my colleague Jason Miller points out, of chief data officers, that kind of throws an extra wrinkle into this as the prominence of the CIOs and the importance of the CIOs kind of at the table is the term that we use all the time, becomes more common. We've spoken on this program on a number of occasions about FATARA, the new legislation that provides a lot more autonomy and budget power for CIOs inside government. However, if they're not able to go and get the stuff they need because of other rules that haven't been addressed yet, that negates potentially some of the gains that they'll make through FATARA, I imagine.
Yeah, and CIOs have so many competing demands on just technology needs and all the things the government's trying to do that they have to make that decision whether to spend it on security or not. Because if they're spending it on security, they're probably slowing down the other demands that are being made on their budgets.
Mm-hmm. I take something positive, though, about your opening comment, Richard, and that is that you see, again, as an outside observer, a dramatic progress, it sounds like, from where you and I were talking about this 2 or 3 years ago, in the ability of chief information officers to get out of the BlackBerry guy business and be in the business of really strategic, long-thinking discussions and planning for their agencies, and to be that person at the table with the chief financial officer and with the head of the agency and so on as a real strategic leader.
Yeah. I think they've gained that attention because, you know, digital government alone is so powerful, and it's the wave of the future, and everybody recognizes it. Who's going to do that? The CIO is going to do that. So, yeah, I think they're finally in a much better position.
The Continuous Diagnostics and Mitigation Program is kind of the state of the art in government right now. How does that compare to the directives that you're seeing large companies taking in the private sector?
Yeah, so large companies were in that position probably a decade ago. The idea of doing continuous vulnerability management, continuous monitoring of alerts. And I think government has an opportunity to learn from the experiences those companies had, and that, you know, they soon learned that it's not enough to just gather all these alerts. And when you're doing continuous vulnerability management, it means every single time that you check that server that you already know is vulnerable, you get another, you know, checkbox to say that's okay. We've already decided it's okay to be vulnerable because it's too difficult to take it off and patch it. We have to go way beyond that because now the way, you know, a typical manufacturer or a bank is addressing cybersecurity is they're looking at, you know, continuous knowledge, situational awareness of the attackers coming into their network and responding to actual breaches as they happen and hopefully before the data is exfiltrated. And that is, you know, light years beyond where doing the continuous vulnerability management is, which comes from, you know, the risk management space, which is, hey, let's reduce our surface area of attack, which is great. And that works perfect for 2003 when there were all these worms and viruses floating around. It has nothing to do with stopping a determined attacker from overseas.
The transition that I've seen is I've seen agencies starting to understand exactly what you're talking about, that the greatest desire now of attackers is to keep the network open and to be able to continue to extract information, not just a one-shot deal.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, ironically, it may be that we would welcome more of the random hackers because they'd show us where all our vulnerabilities are. Unfortunately, we're putting those guys in jail when they do things.
Do you see much of a transition of people from black to white hats anymore?
Not as much as we used to. There's certainly a lot more people going down the white hat path, but there's still a lot of people, Bridget, who've decided, you know, maybe because they're overseas, that they're still going to create 0 days and sell them to the highest bidder. So both sides, I guess, have grown dramatically.
You mentioned a moment ago that the CDM process is similar to what the private sector was doing a fair amount of time ago. Is it necessary, do you think, for the government to follow an evolutionary path and do what the private or some other entity was doing at some period of time because there are building blocks or a foundation they have to build and build on top of that? Or is it possible to make kind of a quantum leap and catch up to be doing the same kinds of things that very high value private sector companies are doing today?
I think so, but I'm an iconoclast. I'm telling people not to waste time at all on IDS, SIM, which is Security Information and Event Management, and just leap forward and start focusing on countering attacks. So it's possible. And, you know, the same way that, you know, Latin American countries just jumped ahead and went to cell phones and never had the wired transmissions. And Estonia did that, too, because they didn't start as a country until 91. The same way, you could get a better security posture faster than some of the big banks because you wouldn't have the legacy security and all of the people that are supporting that. You know, this is the way we've always done it. We can't change, that sort of thing. You could just jump ahead of that.
Mm-hmm. What are the holdups to doing that in your view?
Well, it takes a lot of courage to say, no, we're not going to do it, you know, the way that ITIL and some of the, you know, even the NIST framework is couched in old terms of risk management. So it would take quite a leader to say, I've looked at the problem and we have to stop these breaches from occurring. And the only way to do it is this. We're going to take money and budget away from the other things that you know, NIST framework requires.
Is it possible that that's part of the issue, is that the agencies say, you know what, not only are we doing a risk management strategy here, we're also doing a change management strategy.
Right.
And we have a culture of people who are doing this job for us, both in the agencies and in the industry that are our partners. And if we upset the apple cart tomorrow, we might wind up with a worse result than if we went a little bit more slowly and more deliberately than we could.
Yeah, and the other problem is that this is a top-down push, and it has been for every administration since cyber became a thing. It's, you know, we're going to figure out what needs to be done and then tell everybody how to do it. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what happened, you know, with, you know, we're going to ask NIST to create a framework, which they did. So after over 12 months of putting together conferences and getting people to have their feedback, we came up with the NIST framework, which is just the very beginnings. It's a way to think about having a cybersecurity defense. And that's, you know, when it's top down, you say, okay, let's get compliant with the NIST framework so we can demonstrate it. Our job's done. My job is secure. I get promoted, et cetera. But in the meantime, we get breached.
So your sense is that people are treating that as a ceiling when they should be treating it as a floor.
Exactly.
How do you get that mentality to flip, do you think? Is that, and because that now we're into the culture part, and right. that strikes me that that's the hard part.
Actually, it's fairly easy. You just assign somebody responsible for not being breached. So it's no longer you're responsible for being in compliance with the NIST framework mm-hmm. or whatever other framework. Now it's don't let us be breached. You know, tell us what you need to not be breached. Think about it in terms of your job and livelihood and all the rest. And that's, you know, that's how you get anything done in a large organization, right? Is you push down responsibility to the operational level, and that's what has to happen.
So the one of the concepts behind CDM, as it's been described by to me by folks in the government, is it will get us out of the compliance business that the agencies are in now with FISMA. Do you think these folks are fooling themselves if they think that CDM gets them out of the compliance business?
I think so. I think that, you know, there are technologies that fit under CDM, so the continuous network monitoring, for instance, but that means you've got full-time staff and a security operations center to do that. So it turns out that knowing about your vulnerabilities and having a good patch regime, you know, that's just house cleaning, and it should be done, and it's been done at most organizations that are beyond Windows XP, which unfortunately doesn't include a lot of federal agencies. but... you know, jump leapfrogging that we're talking about in order to be more resilient and have better defenses and really raise the cost for the attackers, which, as we know, are Russian and Chinese. We have to really make them strive to break into our systems, like, you know, the IRS most recently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we learned yesterday that the Internal Revenue Service attack is believed to have emanated from Russia. We don't know, at last I knew, whether it was the Russian government or not. But certainly the indication is that what is the case in China, which is essentially that hackers there operate with the endorsement, at least, of the Chinese government, if not the protection of the government. Same thing appears to be the case in Russia. Is that true?
Yeah, there's a very, very strong connection between the criminal network, which used to be called the Russian Business Network before they went even more underground. And their, you know, history was closely tied to the KGB. So it's certainly a lot of the same operatives that have friends and connections with the power infrastructure inside Russia. So, yeah, there's a strong connection. There's even, you know, there's chatter amongst the security industry that the cyber criminal hackers that we're familiar with coming from Russia have always been told, hands off critical infrastructure. Mm-hmm. You know, don't do anything until some point. And Jay Healy at the Atlantic Council made the strong point that when the risk to doing attacks against our financial system, for instance, fall below a certain level, you know, the risk of repercussion, then all holds will be off, and those attacks will start happening. And the, you know, the cybersecurity community in the industry is quite afraid of the capabilities of the Russian hackers. They do some amazing things.
Mm-hmm. It's helpful, I think, to understand the threat landscape as we know it today. We've talked a little bit about Russia now, and I think we have a pretty good sense of what the landscape looks like vis-a-vis China. But they're not the only sources that somebody as a CIO in a federal agency should be thinking about, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think at the federal level, people still take the approach of, you know, I don't care who the actor is. You know, it's just the method that I have to defend against.
Is that wise?
It is until they're very targeted attacks, because then, you know, with all intelligence, you want to know the intent mm-hmm. of the attacker. And if you know that it is a Russian-based group, then the intent is probably financial. So the attack against the IRS, you can draw the, you know, connect those dots because they're getting financial information. Attacks against Sony, we could draw the dots to North Korea because of the motivation factor. The DDoS attack against the code repository GitHub obviously came from China because we can actually track the packets. So knowing that tells you something about the intent and the whether they'll come back if they don't get what they want. So if you're a, you know, designer of a new weapon system, if you know the types of attackers, you'll know that they're not going to give up just because you stopped their attack today.
Mm-hmm. The understanding that landscape involves understanding that it's going to change. and that there will be new threats emerging. And I don't get a sense that the old threats ever go away. I think even the basement hackers that were around 10 years ago are probably still playing around in their basements.
Yep, and there's probably still more spam today than there was mm-hmm. when we passed the Can't Spam Act.
Right. So how do we continue to watch? Where are the places that we watch in order to remain educated and informed about how the threat landscape evolves?
So I've started to keep an eye on industrial control systems. So we've talked about that forever, and Leon Panetta uses that as the basis for, you know, the fear of a cyber Pearl Harbor, mm-hmm. an attack against our power grid. But you watch vulnerable systems. So certainly medical systems are extremely vulnerable, power grid, manufacturing systems. So you watch for early indicators. You watch for new malware that does attack those. As we've seen in the power grid last year, there are two new versions of malware that attack them. You look for vulnerable systems. You can map those out today because you just scan the internet to find connected industrial control systems. And then you look for the first proof of concept attacks. Last year we had one in Germany where a steel factory had a furnace destroyed, evidently by cyber attack coming out of Russia.
Mm-hmm.
So the capability is there. There might be motivation, you know, economic motivation to hurt a country's ability to produce raw materials or function. So we look at those motivation behind things. The one thing that you know, is a new threat vector that we haven't really seen yet, but we've been talking about it for years, so it's probably time to start thinking about it, and that's the lone wolf cyber attacker. You know, we know what a lone wolf terrorist attacker can do with some homemade bombs. What if one of the more criminal elements in the hacker community were recruited into a jihadist group?
Mm-hmm.
Then we'd have cyber terrorism.
The lone wolf cyber attacker takes me then to the insider threat. And the insider threat obviously was very prominent during the Chelsea Manning, Edward Snowden episodes and so on, as we learned about WikiLeaks. That seems to have receded. The hubbub, the furor around that seems to have receded. And I wonder if that's necessarily a good thing, if that takes the eye off the ball regarding the insider threat.
Yeah, the trouble with the insider is that they have all the knowledge that they need to do the damage.
Mm-hmm.
Jerome Kerviel at Société Générale Bank in France was probably one of the most egregious actors there. They already know how everything works, and they know exactly how to beat the system. And our only defense is we trust them. So inside the intelligence community, everybody's trusted to not be acting against their own government. And of course, you know, you can't trust everybody, because out of 100,000 employees, several of them are going to be working for your adversaries,
mm-hmm.
You know, sleeper spies or whatever. So you have to have controls. You have to treat everybody as if they were a hacker. And once you have those controls in place that restricts access and requires permissions and strong authentication and data is encrypted, then you're also protected when an outsider gets in and gets their credentials and acts as them. Or if your CEO or CFO is targeted, the attacker is going to have their capability, maybe not their knowledge. So the goal is make the system so impervious to malfeasance on the inside that an outsider can't hurt you either.
Are we getting any better at anticipating all of the kinds of attacks that we've talked about so far, Richard, both the outside attacks coming from people and groups with various motivations and the insider threats at determining what the steps are that may lead up to somebody turning or somebody trying to access information that they shouldn't, any of that?
So there are people who are up to speed on that and are better at it. But as a whole, we're where we've always been, mm-hmm. and it's human nature. You know, you don't react to a threat until it's present and in your face. You don't put bars on the windows of your house until your neighbor's house is broken into. Even then, you might actually wait until your house is broken mm-hmm. into. And when you're the last 2% of houses that doesn't have any bars on the windows, then you add them. And you can, it's amazing how far you can take that. Just go to Johannesburg in South Africa, and you'll see what goes way beyond bars on houses.
Mm-hmm.
People are perfectly willing to live that way. The internet, cyberspace in general, is getting more like that, and there are neighborhoods where you do have to lock the doors, turn on the lights, have guard dogs.
There's a story that we see that I saw online this week, and it's a little more prurient than I usually cover here. It's a website that provides, we'll just say, adult services, and then their information's been exfiltrated. Is that something like that, the next generation, do you think, of attacks where, you know, obviously a federal agency doesn't host that kind of information necessarily, but the reason it seems significant to me was because it's the first time I've seen an attack that goes beyond or that takes information beyond the typical kinds of things that you would do to do identity theft.
Yeah, the if you can steal or gain knowledge of somebody's interests or access to particular sites, it's actually got a long history. In the hacker community, they call it doxing. So, you know, just revealing an anonymous identity as a real person with their address and other things like that causes a lot of trouble for those people who have been doxed. And there are many, many people that lead secret lives of one sort or another. And certainly if you're on a matchmaking site, that could indicate your presence there could just indicate that you're having an affair. If you're on a, you know, a prostitution site, same thing, or a drug trading site or just a drug paraphernalia site, mm-hmm. there's a lot of information revealed in that you wouldn't want to be exposed. So the attacks this week were one of the first instances of a mass gathering of that data. So there's a lot of valuable information there, and probably several million people that are extremely concerned about their activities online.
What should, in your view, federal information technology leaders be thinking about today that might not be top of mind or maybe not in their minds at all?
So the thing that I'm kind of on the preaching circuit about right now is that, you know, I'm talking to some of the best and the best in the industry, and I'm telling them that you've got to get, you know, much, much better at response and being able to detect an attack in process and shut the doors before they exfiltrate data. You have to do that today manually, 24/7. It's very, very expensive. Takes, you know, really difficult to find people in order to accomplish it. You have to do it today because you've only got a 2-year window before you have to automate all of that. And that's the, you know, so think ahead to the point where you won't have a response time at all. You'll have 10 seconds max between initial breach and exfiltrated data. So there's no phone call late at night and getting the team together and going into the office and trying to fix a problem. It's you only hear about it after the breach.
Is that being driven by the capabilities of the exfiltrators? Is that what's pushing that?
The exfiltrators today don't have to do that because mm-hmm. they can take all the time in the world. All the APT reports that have come out show this long and slow attack methodology from people that seem to be working 9 to 5, probably in Beijing, and teamwork, you know, so they've got shifts that are coming in and working it late at night. And that's very successful. So they're just doing great. As we get better at defense, they're going to have to get faster and faster. And they're going to see that the need to automate as much as they can. There's only a single example that I can draw on of an automated attack, and that was Stuxnet. Mm-hmm. So, but everybody's seen now what Stuxnet did, how it worked, and what is required. An attack might cost $1 million to set up, but then they push a button and it happens.
And certainly seeing that motivated people to say, I want one of those.
Absolutely.
And go out and build those tools and devote the resources necessary to make them happen.
Yep.
Richard, great to talk to you as always. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Francis.